Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you. As we begin this morning, Daryl's going to lead us in a word of prayer.
Our Father in heaven, thank you for this day. Thank you for this opportunity that's before us in this hour to study a portion of your word and to be reminded and perhaps learn things that we hadn't learned before about your word that may help us in our day-to-day walk. Pray that you'll forgive our sins. Pray that you'll be with Joe as he directs the class. Help us as participants to be able to be attentive and to be learning, listening always, and pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. So we've spent a little more time looking at the trials of Paul than I had anticipated. But with a lot of things, there's always a backstory. There's always some reason why events take place. And so here we are at Paul's fifth defense. I mean, we started with, you know, the first defense on the steps of the barracks when the Jewish mob was wanting to kill Paul. Paul's reputation preceded him when he came back to Jerusalem. But all that had been said about him was not entirely true. The Jews had been told that Paul was saying that Moses should be rejected and that the law was of no benefit, that they should neglect, disregard the traditions that they had known for so long. That's not what Paul was saying. That's not what he was teaching. He was teaching that circumcision and keeping the law was not necessary to be a Christian, but he was not saying those things that those who were against him were saying. Well, the commander, Lysias, kind of pulled him from the crowd and saved him more than once. His second defense was before the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, supposedly the wisest of the Jews, those who are in a position of making some judgments about things spiritual. But as it turns out, they wanted to kill him too. And the Sanhedrin, in that instance, was divided on Paul's testimony, and I suppose that saved him. That saved his life. Because they could not come together to be able to make some kind of a decision, and Lysias took him out of that situation as well. Well, Paul's third defense came as he stood before Felix. So now he's at the king's palace. He's in Caesarea, and he stood before the Jewish leaders who had come and before the governor. And Paul's arguments there, again, prove that there was no just charge against him. His accusers were without proof. They could make charges. They couldn't prove anything. Now, Felix could have released Paul, but he procrastinated, remember? He waited. He didn't want to make the judgment. And that perhaps for some selfish reasons, not wanting to anger the Jews was one thing. If he had let Paul go, that would have made the Jews angry. He didn't want that. And if he kept Paul in prison for a while, who knows? Paul may have got tired enough about being there to offer him a bribe. And so maybe there was different reasons why Felix procrastinated. His fourth defense was before Festus. After 2 years in prison, you would think, you know, surely now a fair trial would come about, you know, when Felix is no more. Festus comes in, he's the new procurator or the new governor, and he heard the whole story again. Accusations from the Jews and defense from Paul. But Festus as well seemed unwilling to render judgment, I think again fearing the Jews, and Paul appealed to Caesar. Well, that takes us up close to where we are now in the story. The fifth defense of Paul comes as he stands before Agrippa. And again, the Jews had no fresh evidence. And Paul stood in his own defense. And he preached to Agrippa as one having an understanding of the law. That, speaking of Agrippa, that he was one who had an understanding of the law. And Paul preached to him that way, basically saying, and you understand these things, Agrippa. You understand the prophets, what they said. You understand the law. And so he appealed to him in this way. And Paul gave full testimony of his conversion as he's done twice or as he's done before. And he preached the way of eternal life to King Agrippa and to those who were in the company there. And so we find Agrippa to be in a hard place. What is he going to do? And in our last class, Wednesday night, we talked a lot about Agrippa. We spent the biggest part of the class, you know, kind of talking about Agrippa. He's not actually the main part of the story. Well, I suppose he is for a short time here. But it's interesting to know some things about Agrippa, because that has a lot to do with why Paul made the defense that he made. It has a lot to do with why Paul said the things that he said. To know something about Agrippa. Now let's think back just a little bit to Wednesday night. Like, who is Agrippa? He's not the first one to come along being named Agrippa. Remember, if we look at this map, we go back to Herod the Great, which would have been like the Agrippa that we're talking about today. Let's see, his great-grandfather. This would be his great-grandfather, Herod the Great. Remember, Herod the Great is the one who built the city of Caesarea, where Paul is at right now, made it the magnificent city that it is. Herod the Great is the one who built the great walls around the city of Jerusalem, some of which you can still see today, built the temple there. And so Herod the Great, he was a builder. He did some things in that region that stand as monuments today, really. And, you know, Herod the Great, I mean, his territory was kind of this dark line all the way around here like this. And, of course, including Jerusalem down here and Caesarea here, where that great city was built. But as time went on, you know, remember we talked about when he died, three of his sons took over that same territory. It was divided between the three of them. But in time, it's his grandson, Agrippa I, who is only serving over a portion of that territory. For a while, he did come back and serve over that great territory. But then after that, when Agrippa I died, there was no one ready to take his place. His son, Agrippa II, was still a young man. I think he was 17 when Agrippa I died. And the emperor at the time was not willing to give him that kingdom. And so he just put in place some other Roman governors that led that area. Well, in time, Agrippa II, whom we are talking about in our story, that is who Paul is addressing, Agrippa II. Well, he didn't have that whole territory that his father and his great-grandfather had. But he did serve in the area near Judea. He had some area around Galilee and to the west of the Jordan River, Pyria. That was the area that he had his reign. But also he was given, remember, responsibility in Jerusalem, that he had responsibility over the temple. I find this kind of interesting and somewhat perplexing, that while he did not rule over Judea, he had rule over the temple in Judea. And so he had responsibility, not given by the law of Moses, but given by the emperor, to, in Jerusalem, appoint the high priests. Well, that didn't set just real well with the Jewish leaders. That's not the way they wanted to see that done. But that's the way that the emperor said it was to be done. And so Agrippa II spent some time in Jerusalem. And it seems, history would say, tried to appease some of the needs of the Jews there. Because now here we are at 60 AD, and the difficulties between the Jewish leadership and Rome is increasing. It's really tuning up. It's going to get to a fever pitch here pretty soon. And it's going to end in a very destructive way. And Agrippa is the one who is trying to keep Rome happy. That's his number one job, remember. It helps you keep your head on top of your neck if you keep Rome happy. And so he's got to make Rome happy. At the same time, most say that he was a Jew. And he was certainly sympathetic to some of the Jewish needs and some of the things that the Jews want. It seems as though perhaps he understood some of the problems that they were dealing with in Jerusalem and some of the problems that the Jewish leaders were fighting over. the factions in Jerusalem continued to grow. We've already seen just with our episodes with Paul, the Sanhedrin was greatly divided. There were other factions too among the Jews. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees were the largest of the sects among the Jews, but there were others. And there were the Zealots, those who were, if we could use the term, some have said like the terrorists of that day among the Jews. They were very zealous for what they believed. And they would stop at nothing to try to get their way among the Jews. This was a growing group. And they were causing more problems. And in fact, when we start to see, when we get to the period of time where there is the Jewish revolt, as some have called it, that takes place in 66 AD, it's the Zealots that are kind of leading the charge on that. So you see, there's a lot to the backstory. There's a lot going on behind the scenes when Paul is in Caesarea, been there for 2 years, and Agrippa, you know, comes and says, okay, I'll hear his story. You know, Agrippa did not have jurisdiction in Caesarea. Do we realize that? I mean, that was Festus. That was his area. And so, you know, Festus had Agrippa come because he was acquainted with the Jews. He was the one who had influence with those Jewish leaders back in Jerusalem who were wanting to kill Paul and who had made these charges. And so that's why Agrippa came. And I suppose, too, that, you know, Festus being the new guy on the block, having this king, every leader was not a king. That's a different appointment. Festus was a governor over this area, perhaps an area as big as that of Agrippa's. But he wasn't a king. Agrippa was a king. And so that is a title that would come from Rome, from the emperor, who could, you know, crown someone, I suppose you would say, a king. And so the dynasty of Herod, well, it's about to come to an end. I think we mentioned on Wednesday that from it lasted about 100 years. Herod the Great, you know, then some of his sons, grandson, great grandson, some other family members. There were, I think, 5 who were kings during that period of time. Agrippa's going to be the last one of that dynasty. And it's still going to run. It's going to run to about 100 AD, but it's not going to be in Jerusalem. I mean, the reign of King Agrippa II, it's going to come to an end in the territory where he is. But in time, he's going to be given another territory. He's going to be king, and he's going to be, you know, a well-thought-of king from Rome. But it's not going to have a great deal to do with what's happening with this trial of Paul. Remember, Agrippa's just trying to figure out, how can we calm this down? How can we try to resolve this? Well, he's not going to be able to resolve it. Because in the end of the story there with Paul, remember, he had already appealed to Caesar, to Felix. And the question that came from Felix to Agrippa is, what am I going to say? I mean, he said, I have to write a letter to Rome saying, here are the charges against this man. Felix had already determined there was no just charge. Festus has determined now there's no just charge. And basically, Agrippa's going to say the same thing. But he's appealed to Caesar. To Caesar he has to go. Agrippa was not in a position, once that plea was made, well, you know, I appeal to Caesar, Festus wasn't really in a position to say, no, I'm not going to send you to Caesar. Oh, no. Paul had rights being a Roman citizen. You make an appeal to Caesar, unless you are the one that says, okay, I changed my mind, then, you know, the ruler is going to send him on to Caesar. So that's where it's at. That's where the situation is at right now. So you see, there's a lot to the backstory. There's a lot going on in the background that is bringing about some of these things here that are coming about. So it's around 60 AD. It was in 48 that Agrippa received authority over the affairs of the temple in Jerusalem. So it's been 12 years or so that he's been involved in that responsibility. Let's have in our mind the fact that Agrippa II was an ardent collaborator with Rome, someone said, just like his father had been and his great-grandfather. You know, that they are doing everything they can to appease Rome. They have a connection. You know, sometimes it's nice to have connections. And here was a king who had connections in Rome that went back literally for generations. So if Agrippa said something to Rome about certain things, it got the ears of people. That was the position that Agrippa II had. And so he gained rule then over the appointment of the high priest, as we said. And between 52 and 60 AD, he appointed several high priests. And in the process, really, that put him in good stead with Rome, because in the eyes of Rome, he's keeping peace among those Jews down there. Man, they've been a problem. Just fix that down there. But in doing that, appointing those priests, it built enmity between him and the conflicting parties. Imagine this. You have to come in and appoint a priest, which is not really the rule or the responsibility of a king. That's a whole other story. But now, when in doing so, he can never make the different parties among the Jews all happy. You appoint a high priest that's from the Pharisees, then you've made the Sadducees mad, and vice versa, or the other sects. So those never making everyone happy. And that's part of the turmoil that's going on now, too. You know, that's part of what's pulling in all of that. And so he was not making friends in Jerusalem. You know, by and large, it is said that Agrippa avoided the politics in Judea. Judea was not really his territory. Just Jerusalem in Judea was his territory. And so in 60, when Paul was arrested, the procurator, the governor at the time, Festus, consulted Agrippa. What do I do? I mean, what do I do with this guy? You know, I've got to write a letter to Caesar. What am I going to say? That's why the events take place that we're reading about in chapter 25. You think about in Acts chapter 25, just trying to get the atmosphere in that meeting. You know, when it begins, you know, in chapter 25, verse 13, after some days, King Agrippa and Bernice came to Caesarea to greet Festus. And when they had been there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, and you know, he explained the story. Here's the problem that I have. Here's what's going on. And so that's where we are at here in this story. I mean, look, I had a couple of slides. Oh, yeah. Going back to that palace again in Caesarea. And I envisioned that where some of this is taking place and where this trial is going to take place concerning Paul. It says in the judgment hall. I'm wondering if that's that what some have called the audience hall right here outside of the palace. And of course, Paul was being kept, you know, right here in these administrative offices, at least in the cells right there, is what most would believe. Seems like that can be a logical place. But when this trial actually takes place, we're not quite there yet. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance that goes along with the king entering in, you know, to the judgment hall and the trial there that is about to take place. And so we ask again, like one of our questions was, you know, why would Festus seek the help of Agrippa? Well, we've talked about that some already. You know, Festus knew Agrippa had the reputation of being the authority on the Jewish belief, the customs, the prejudices that were so very prevalent among the Jews. And so he told him about the situation here and asking him, you know, what shall I do? Verse 14. And when they had been there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there is a certain man left in prison by Felix, about whom the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me when I was in Jerusalem, asking for a judgment against him. To them I answered, it is not the custom of the Romans to deliver any man to die before he who is accused meets the accusers face to face and has opportunity to answer for himself concerning the charge laid against him. Therefore, when they had come together without delay, the next day I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought in. When the accusers stood up, they brought no accusation against him of such things as I supposed, but had some questions against him about their own religion and about one Jesus who has died, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And because I was uncertain of such questions, I asked him whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there be judged concerning these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved for the decision of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept till I could send him to Caesar. So that's kind of the recap here that Augustus or that Festus gave to Agrippa. Here's what's going on, he said. I mean, that there were really no accusations, just some questions about him and about his relationship to the law and the Jews. And then, you know, Paul gave his defense and then appealed to Caesar. So now the situation is close to the new trial, so to speak, with Agrippa. Neil.
It almost sounds as if Felix really didn't leave any records with regards to the first trial, because he said it's against Roman law to condemn someone without them facing the accusers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he had.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently when Felix left,
he didn't leave a written record. Perhaps that's right.
That doesn't sound like he left a record, which is...
But, of course, when they were before Felix as well, the accusations were the same. You know, I mean, it doesn't appear that the story has changed. I think I said Wednesday night, it's like, here it is 2 years later. I mean, the Jewish leaders aren't being just real honest about this whole thing to begin with. I'm surprised they didn't come in with some false accusers. At least they'd have a new story.
But there should have been a record saying, well, he has faced his accusers.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it faced his accusers, and Felix unable or unwilling to make a judgment. Remember, he could have made a judgment. Of course, that would have put him in the crosshairs of those Jewish leaders if he'd made a judgment of innocence of Paul. And we even talked about, too, what if Paul had been released at that time? Would he be alive now at this point? I mean, chances are. I mean, what was one of the first things the Jewish leaders said to Festus? Remember when Festus was coming down to Jerusalem? Well, just bring that man along. Give us opportunity to kill him along the way. You know, that's what they wanted to kill him one way or another. Didn't matter if it was legal or not. That was their goal. That was their purpose in that. Look a little farther, verse 22. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, he said, Festus said, you will hear him. And the next day, when Agrippa and Bernice had come with great pomp and had entered the auditorium with the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at Festus's command, Paul was brought in. I don't know how much pomp and circumstances involved here, but there must be some. I mean, I don't know how many people are in the judgment hall, how many have come, and why it's an interest to the leading men of Caesarea to come. Well, had they come to know Paul? He's been there for 2 years. He's not been prohibited from having visitors come and go and teach. I mean, are there any Christians that's coming to this assembly to hear this? I don't know. But you wonder, who are those who are coming? Besides the traveling companions of the king, his generals, or whoever that would be there. But that's the scene here as it unfolds. Verse 24. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all the men who are here present with us, you see this man about whom the whole assembly of the Jews petitioned me, both at Jerusalem and here, crying out that he ought not to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I decided to send him. I have nothing certain to write to my Lord concerning him. Therefore, I have brought him out before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the examination has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not signify the charges against him. So we get the recap, we get the story, and we get the reason behind Festus saying, Agrippa, I need you to help me on this. What am I going to tell the Caesar? I mean, I have nothing to accuse him of. And so that's what we see unfolding. I mean, what is he going to say? A little bit more about Agrippa. Can I say a little more? Is it possible to say more about Agrippa? We've said a lot. A little more about Agrippa. Agrippa II was overthrown by his Jewish subjects in 66 AD, those in Jerusalem. And from then on, history records that he was on the Roman side in the first Jewish-Roman war, as some have called it, the revolt that took place in 66. But it was not without Agrippa making an impassioned plea, you know, to the Jews in Jerusalem. I don't know exactly all that he said, but I can only imagine it to be, you know, y'all about to get hurt. You don't need to go up against Rome. You better calm down and kiss and make up, because Rome is not going to continue to let all of this go on. So from 60 AD, when Paul was on trial in Caesarea, and Agrippa had gone there to hear the trial, things continue to deteriorate in Jerusalem. Things have come to just a bad way there. And so after that first revolt, or some, as some have said, that first battle or war that took place in 66, then Agrippa makes some decisions, and he's fully supporting Rome and some of the actions and the things that they do here in the time that is to take place. But here's what Josephus said regarding when Agrippa goes to Jews to Jerusalem, and he's trying to say, you know, cut this out. You've got to quit this. Well, here's what one historian said, that he employed his brilliant eloquence to warn the inflamed leaders against extremes and counseled the return so far as possible to calmness and deliberation. And so he called the Jewish leaders together to warn of the destruction that would come from Rome if they did not calm down. And Josephus speaks to these things and records what he calls a very moving speech. You remember what we said about Agrippa in his early days? He's raised in Rome, or at least he spent time in Rome in his, I guess, late teens and through his 20s, kind of in the courts there. He was educated well, and he learned how to express himself well as a lawyer would. And so when you see something written about any address that is made by Agrippa II, he speaks with great eloquence of words. And so he is making a plea in Jerusalem to the Jewish leaders in words that I don't know that are exactly recorded, but we get the idea and the point of what is being said. I thought I had a quote by Josephus here, but now I'm not finding it. It's somewhere in all these notes, but I don't see it. But he's making a very powerful plea to them. A little bit more of a backstory. In 64 A.D., just a little before this revolt, the emperor, who is now Nero, appointed Gessius Florus as the procurator over the Judea province there. He didn't do anything, it would seem, to help ease any of the civil unrest or the tensions there. In fact, he inflamed the tensions. He went to Jerusalem and he went to the temple. And he took from there all of the riches, the treasury of the temple. And he did so saying that this is to pay taxes to Caesar. It didn't really matter what reason he gave. It wasn't a good reason. It wasn't the truth. And that really incited the Jews. So they already had their internal conflicts going. They're already not happy with Rome. You know, Agrippa has been trying to appease some of these things. And now this new procurator, this governor, comes in and takes all the treasury from the temple. I mean, the battle's on. It's like there's no turning it back, really, you know, from this point. And so in 66, it was the procurator, Jesseus Florus, again, who permitted the massacre of Jews in Jerusalem. He was bad. Nothing like what's going to happen in 4 years, though. I mean, it was just a precursor of what was yet to come. And so it was the riots that ensued with that were horrific. And the instigators of those riots among the Jews were taken, they were taken captive, and they were taken to Rome, not for a trial. They were taken there to be killed. They were being used as an example. You make riots in Jerusalem, here's what's going to happen to you. They didn't calm things down. It only continued to make things worse in Jerusalem. And so Agrippa, at least to some degree, supported Florus, the procurator, the governor, using some moderation. And in doing so, he did have some persuasive ability to get the governor to kind of back up on this a little bit, to maybe rethink. But in the process of doing that, Jerusalem didn't calm down, but they used that as an opportunity to call to arms, and the zealots just came out in full force, and the battle was on again. But they weren't going to win. They were not going to win against Rome. Now, of course, by this point in time, Paul's in a completely different place. We've kind of stepped ahead in the story of this, just understanding what was going on here in the backstory of all of this. Agrippa? What's going to happen to Agrippa? Well, trouble continued to threaten his own kingdom. I mean, not just Jerusalem, but Galilee and Perea, his own kingdom. The Jewish revolt has kind of moved all the way up into his area, you know, there too. And so he sent some troops to Jerusalem, you know, a number of troops to help support Rome in the revolt that was taking place there. Their troops, his troops, came under a great siege and gave up and surrendered in the summer of 66. And that didn't work out just real well. And the rebels massacred the Roman garrison that Agrippa had sent in. What do you think Agrippa's posture is going to be now to the Jews? It's not favorable. Not at all. In fact, when the battle takes place in 70 AD, when Jerusalem falls, Agrippa was giving all the support he could to Rome, to Vespasian, the general who marches on Jerusalem. And even though he is going to wind up with no territory left after the great battles there, Agrippa we're speaking of, he goes back to Rome. And having been supportive of Rome in this effort, he's going to be rewarded for that. And he's going to be given a territory, perhaps some have said, even greater than the territory that he had had in Palestine because of his support of all of this. So we went way ahead in that story, just kind of to here's what happens. So when we come back to our text and we find Agrippa in Caesarea listening to Paul, remember what he's really trying to do is he's trying to avoid all that's going to happen in the next few years. This is Paul's story, while it is central to the Bible story, is only this big in what's happening in world events. The Bible story doesn't cover all world events. It's not about all world events. The Bible story is God's message about what's happening among His people and what He wants us to do and how He wants us to respond when there are all of these world events going on around us. Today, I think there's some world events going on around us. I'm not sure how you would judge that, but I kind of think that there are world events going on around us. Some of them I don't much care for. In fact, there's kind of a lot of them that I don't much care for. But I find myself in not much of a position to affect or change many of those events. What does God want us to do? What did God want Paul to do? What did Paul want the Christians of the first century to do? We can't ignore world events. They affect our lives every day. But I don't see where Paul's focus is on the world events that to the Jewish world was at a cataclysmic point. And yet there's little said in God's record about any of these events we're talking about. And we're just touching the hem of the garment. We're only talking about Palestine and Rome. There are many, many, many other countries and events going on. But the Bible story has a focus about how we should live before God. And it transcends time. And it doesn't matter if we lived in the days of Moses or in the days of the prophets or in the days of the Lord or the days of the early disciples. The story and the point is still the same. God expects His people to stand out from the world and to serve Him. And when we come back to the story of Paul, which in world events is minuscule, in God's eyes it's huge. When we come back to the story of Paul and we listen to what Paul is saying to this king and the testimony that Paul gives, we can see and we can understand what is of the greatest importance in the eyes of God. What are some of your thoughts? I've taken the whole time this morning. Some of your thoughts about these events and what we see with Paul.
A do-nothing bunch of leaders.
Yeah, leaders that were making the wrong choices. They thought they were doing a lot. In the eyes of God, not so much.
I was wondering why Agrippa brought in the men of the town, commanders and all these people to help him write a letter to Caesar.
So like Festus is the one who called in Agrippa saying, I don't know what to write in this letter. And those others, the generals of Agrippa and the leaders of the city, I don't know that they would have anything to add to the letter. I think it's more a question that Festus is petitioning Agrippa about. I got to send this guy to Caesar, but I don't know what to say. I think it's really between them. But there's a trial taking place. And so, I mean, it's just like here. We can go to the courthouse any day, and we can go in there, and we can listen to a trial. And I suppose, and I think it had something, the fact that it was the leaders of the city, it must have brought some prestige. I don't think they had a say in it. It wasn't, they had no say. This was about Agrippa making a judgment. Not anybody, there was no jury. He was the judge, jury, and all. You know, so I don't think it had anything getting any information from them. It was just, what does Agrippa have to say about this?
My thought is it's probably a spectacle and something that they, you know, they didn't have closed circuit television. They, you know,
right.
They didn't have television at all. They didn't have anything to entertain them, you know, so. You know, the influential people, you know, might have had the opportunity to go in and,
right.
You know, and knowing what was going on to some extent. That's my thing. The only thing I could think of.
And again, that Paul had been there for 2 years. Certainly he had some reputation. you know, in that city. Because there are those who came in and out, you know, to him, and he's taught many. Neil, and then Ken.
Looking at some of this, one, I think, Leonard Agrippa had heard of Paul, since a lot of his, some of his work was in part of his area of brain. So, let's hear the story. I've heard the side.
At least it must have been by reputation. Perhaps he never had heard Paul before. It seems they were just introduced. But by reputation, yeah, certainly you would think so. Just like those who had heard Jesus, not personally, but they knew of his reputation.
And as far as the letter, by having all these authorities involved too, he sort of spreads the blame.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't have anything to write. Yeah. We have to write something. So let's everyone put something into this. Rome used to read it, but it's not like, well, I just didn't feel like doing my job.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked with all these people.
Yeah. We still can't decide what to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, perhaps. Oh, Ken?
I wonder if Agrippa was warning these Jewish leaders about what was going to come if they did not settle down.
Mm-hmm.
If they were as blind as the previous Jewish leaders and said, God's not going to allow that to happen.
Right.
He's not going to allow Jerusalem to be destroyed or this temple to be torn down.
Yeah. Again, informed but uninformed, because Jesus had already foretold the destruction of Jerusalem. I mean, he had already foretold what was going to happen. Didn't say when exactly, but, you know, here it's coming. And now we're just a short time away. Good comments. Anything else?
Well, I think it's interesting. Festus' explanation to Agrippa, he said, well, as far as I can tell, it's just about this dead man that Paul asserts to be alive. How clueless he himself seems to be about what's going on.
Yes.
And when we know that Agrippa is not clueless about it.
That's an interesting point. You know, because I do think we see here a distinction between Festus and Agrippa, because Agrippa is much more informed. And it's a little peculiar to me how Festus could be so uninformed, other than he wants to be. I mean, we already, when we talked about Festus, he'd lived a very worldly life, you know, with regard to morality and marriage, you know, things. He'd lived a very worldly life. And so now he's hearing about, you know, he says, I mean, he's talking about this Jesus who was supposed to be dead, but Paul says he's alive. I don't know. Is he dead or alive? You know. And so that's just his view on that. And they say he's dead. They say he's alive. I don't know. But Agrippa, you know, he's coming from a different vantage point. I mean, I'm not saying that he knew Jesus. I'm not saying that he's heard the gospel preached before. I'm not saying that he's going to have the gospel preached to him. But he's, you know, he's more informed because of his Jewish background. It makes for kind of an interesting setup, for which we're not going to get into it now. But, you know, when Paul stands up to make his defense, talks about his own conversion, and becomes very persuasive to Agrippa, it has some effect. But then we think about the position that Agrippa is in. I mean, what if Agrippa was so persuaded as to become a Christian? What kind of position does that put him in? As being this king and the procurator over the events at the temple, and he becomes a Christian. How's that going to play out? So, I mean, all of this is in the mind of Agrippa as well. Has to be. So you see, there's a lot of ramifications now that would happen and take place if Agrippa was so moved to become a disciple.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like that since Paul's eyes were open,
mm-hmm.
that the Jews feel like he's turned against them.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's. I'm sure that's how they view that, you know. But Paul is just saying, I wish you were like me, except these chains. When he preaches to them about Christ and his conversion, you know, I just wish you were like me. I wish you'd, you know, and so that's where Paul's going. All right, our time is gone. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your comments.